Welcome to the Long Thread Podcast about spinning, stitching, and weaving by hand. The podcast is presented by Long Thread Media, publishers of Spinoff, Handwoven, Piecework, and Little Looms magazines. Find us online at longthreadmedia.com. Trinway Silks is where weavers, spinners, knitters, and stitchers find the silk they love. Select from the largest variety of silk spinning fibers, silk yarn, and silk threads and ribbons at trinwaysilks.com. You'll discover a rainbow of colors thoughtfully hand-dyed in Colorado. Love natural? Trinway's array of wild silks provide choices beyond white. If you love silk, you'll love Trinway Silks, where superior quality and customer service are guaranteed. At Stewart Heritage Farm in New Market, Tennessee, Farm to Fiber and Yarn has been part of their story for 20 years. Home to a small herd of alpacas, Stewart Heritage produces small batch roving, yarn, and finished goods in 100% alpaca and natural blends, in natural tones and brilliant hand-dyed colors. Discover the fine quality, long-lasting comfort, and soft luxury of alpaca to wear and enjoy in your home. Explore and shop alpaca at stewartheritagefarm.com. I'm your host, Long Thread Media co-founder Anne Merrow. Alyssa Allen finds color where most people would never think of looking for it, under their feet. She's a natural dyer specializing in mushroom and lichen dyes, which she forages and teaches across North America. So Alyssa, thanks for being with me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Your company is called Mycopigments. Can you tell me what that means?
Well, mycopigments was a term that I came up with when I first was getting started with mushroom dyeing in a more public way. So myco means mushroom, or comes from the word for mushroom, so mycology. And then pigments, they were just the colors that I was getting from mushroom dyes. That name was coined in probably 2011 or maybe even a little bit before then. And I didn't start my mycopigments as my full-time endeavor until 2012.
The first time I heard about mushroom dyeing, it seemed like, wow, this is some radical new idea, but it's not really a new idea, is it?
No. So the grandmothers of mushroom dyeing really got their start, I think, in the late 60s, early 70s. And Miriam Rice is known as the first person to publish on the art of mushroom dyeing in the sense of gathering rainbows of color from mushrooms. So there is a longer history of using mushrooms in textile dyeing, but the notion of getting reds and blues and purples from mushrooms really got its start with Miriam's first book.
What do you think makes people look for color in mushrooms? I mean, you already know it's there, but...
Well, I mean, some of the mushrooms that I use are like brown or beige, and then they give a purple dye. Or some, I have one of my favorite mushrooms, Omphalotus olivescens, stains my hands orange for a week. Can I get orange dye out of it? No, it gives purple and green. So mushrooms are really tricky. So, I mean, just looking for brightly colored things in the woods is human nature and animal nature. But looking for colors beneath what you see on the surface, that, I don't know, is reserved for the mad scientists, I think. The chemists.
Can one get a rainbow in one place? Or is this something that's very heavily place dependent and it sort of depends where you are, what colors you can get?
Yeah. So every place has its regional rainbow, what I call a regional rainbow. And whether that rainbow includes red, yellow, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and purple is very dependent on a lot of factors. Rain and trees are essential in variety of fungi. So making sure, if you want all of those kind of exotic colors, you need to go to a place that really supports a diverse range of fungi. And fungi is a very broad term, but so macro fungi, specifically big things that you can see, mushroomy things. So like the desert in Arizona is not going to give you as much of a diverse range of color as a place like the wetter parts of the northern part of the U.S. Mm.
So did you come to this as a textile person or as an outdoors person or as a plant person? Where does your interest come from?
Well, yeah, it's evolved, but my mom was a wild food forager. And so all of my life, I've been out in nature looking for things to stick in my mouth. And I was a very adventurous eater as a child. And so I was just very much on board with going wild food foraging. And we started our adventures in that in Florida, on beachside Florida, and moved to the Pacific Northwest, where it's a very different menu of wild edible plants and whatnot. So we moved here in the fall, and it was an exceptional mushroom year. So then I started looking at mushrooms too. I wasn't so excited about eating mushrooms as a little kid, but as I grew older, I got more interested in that aspect. I was really interested in herbalism growing up through my 20s. And then in my early 20s, I found the Puget Sound Mycological Society. And they just took everybody under their wing and taught them mushroom identification skills. And I just learned so much from those early years at the Puget Sound Mushroom Club. So that's where my interest really blossomed into identifying mushrooms from each other and using microscope to look at mushrooms closer and trying to keep track of the fungi that were occurring in certain areas. So my science side was really engaged in that. And that's where I was first introduced to using mushrooms for dyes.
I remember going out and looking mushroom walks with my parents, were really involved in land preservation and open space. I remember going out on mushroom walks with a man who seemed very strange. And now in retrospect, I wish I could talk to him because he sounds so cool now. But the big question was, is it edible? Does it make good eating? And does it make fatal eating? Those were the two things that we looked for in mushrooms. So looking for color is a totally different aspect.
Yeah, it really takes that anxiety out. So a lot of people don't even bother looking at mushrooms because they're like, well, I don't like mushrooms. I'm not going to risk my life to eat something. So I'm just not even going to look at, why bother even looking at mushrooms? And so a lot of my first time students will come at it and say, now I have a reason to look at mushrooms. And it takes that fear. Like, you don't have to eat it. As a matter of fact, rule number one, never drink the dye bath. Never. No matter how good it smells.
Yeah.
Some people get very excited about the smells coming from the dye pots. I'm like, don't be fooled.
Would I recognize them as food smells, or are they like perfumey smells?
Yeah. Some of the mushroom dyes are from edible mushrooms. So you will have a pot of porcini pores stewing on the dye pot, and we'll use that for color. But when you're working with mushrooms for color, you want old, rotten specimens. Oh. So usually, So especially for the two edibles that I use. So lobster mushroom is a delicious edible. Both of these are very like high-end, delicious wild foods. But if you are a dyer, you're looking for the rotten ones. They kind of all smell the same when they're cooking, but you wouldn't want to ever ingest anything that we use for dyes.
What colors do you get from porcini and lobster claw? I would assume brown and red, but there's always a mysterious story.
Yeah. So lobster mushroom can give any range from very deep reds to kind of rose pinks to bright orange to magenta, depending on pH, mainly depending on pH. When you're working with dyes, you use things called mordants, which are mineral salts that can shift or accentuate colors that are inherent in the fungus. With lobster mushroom, the mordants don't seem to be very necessary for achieving color. And that's the case with a lot of mushrooms. You can ignore that aspect of natural dyeing. Where plant dyes, from what I understand, are more dependent on those mordants to get the colors to stick to the fiber and whatnot. With mushrooms, there are several fungi that work best without adding mineral salts to get the color. So lobster is one of those. So you just don't have to add anything, but you can play with the pH to get the color that you are after. And with porcini, you can get a beautiful, brilliant, bright yellow.
Wow. I didn't know that.
And you can get some shades of green as well if you add iron.
There's an artisanal mushroom grower not too far from me, and I went to him at a farmer's market, and I asked him about mushrooms for dyeing, and he clearly thought that I was talking about dyeing without the E, and he turned his back and he wouldn't talk to me. So it is this whole other element that even people who are professionals are kind of like, I don't know about that.
Yeah, it's a different avenue. And so, and that's starting to change. There's starting to be more food foragers who are learning about dye mushrooms and the value that they have to the dyeing community. And so their foragers love to forage useful things. So if they know that they're looking for dyer's polypore, in addition to the things that they're filling their basket with for market, then a lot of them are perfectly happy to pick those for the dye community as well.
So you heard that it was possible to use these for color, but it's more than just sort of a passing interest. This is something that you are now totally immersed in. How did you become a textile person?
I started teaching about the mushrooms and the dyes, and my first few classes that I offered to the public were through the Puget Sound Mycological Society. And at first it was mushroom people that were coming to my workshops. And then I noticed this shift, and the textile people were starting to catch wind of it. And so there were more textile people than mushroom people. And they asked me very difficult questions about wool and mordants and how you treat your wool and how you work with it. And I learned some very difficult lessons during that period where I really had to learn more about fiber. I shrunk things. I dyed things in the wrong order. I had this beautiful collection of blue dye mushrooms. I was so excited to dye this wool with. So I put it, but I didn't want the mushroom bits to get in contact with that wool, because then I'd have to try and get them out of the fiber. And this was a fleece kind of wool, so fluffy. And so I stuck it into a pantyhose sock and dyed the whole thing. And the pantyhose took all the dye, and the fiber inside didn't get any of it, because nylon is very chemically similar to protein fibers. And so it took the dye lovely and nothing for the fiber. Oh. So I learned some of these things the hard way. But over time, I have enough experience now to understand fiber in a different way.
And now a word from our sponsors. Brown Sheep Company is a 4-generation family business bringing you high-quality wool and natural fiber yarns. We spin and dye U.S.-grown wool into hundreds of vibrant colors at our mill in western Nebraska. Our mill has something to offer for every craft, from well-known knitting and crochet yarns to wool roving for spinning and felting. We offer U.S.-made needlepoint yarns as well as yarn on cones for weaving. Learn more about our company and products at brownsheep.com. And now back to the show. Over time, do you still find surprising colors in the mushrooms that you're seeing? Or do you sort of know from experience, I look at this, I will get this color?
So mushrooms are really, they're very tricky in that taxonomically, they've been called the same species from East Coast to West Coast. For instance, there's been a lot of lumping of species over the course of mushrooms being more understood. And now, so if you look at a book and you say, okay, Hydnellum pekii, the bleeding tooth fungus, it's very beautiful and gets these little red droplets all over it, and it makes a blue-green dye. In certain areas, I know that that's going to give me a really deep teal green. And in other areas, I collect it and I'm lucky to get a slightly sagey gray. Now, they haven't been split yet, as far as I know. It could have changed recently. So they're still called the same species, but I have a feeling that there are some nuances that are going to divide those types of fungi. And so I see that in the collections that I make. So I'm always learning about how to work with my fungi, how to get a better, stronger color, and what route to take to get to that color. So is it better to soak these things for a week before you use them? Or is it better to let them get really rotten before using them? Sometimes I think I know the answer, and then I'll try following that protocol and come up with a totally different result than I'm expecting. So I'm definitely still a student of this as well.
When you say try that different protocol, what are the different factors? You mentioned how basically the age of the mushroom, but what are the different factors and that go into devising a protocol?
Yeah. So experience is, I mean, just playing, that's my kind of my first approach, is I really like to keep things playful, or I'm not stressing too much about writing a protocol or anything like that. But I do take note, like, where did I collect it geographically and what trees were around? There are some species that have been called the same thing, but we know that they are probably different because they associate with different trees. And maybe, or maybe they haven't been split taxonomically yet. But so I try to keep note when I'm collecting of any variables that I can recognize. And then the type of water plays a role, the type of fiber, the pH of everything, the mineral content of everything, the diet that the animal had before they got sheared actually plays a role. So people will often ask, does it make a difference if you use a different type of water? And every little thing makes a difference. So then in that way, it kind of doesn't matter because there's no way to get a standardized result anyways. So you might as well just enjoy the randomness of the whole process of nature.
Is the dye process with mushrooms similar to other kinds of dye stuffs where maybe you could make an extract, but mostly you weigh it out by weight of goods and you put it in the dye pot and boil it for a time, et cetera?
Basic process is collecting the fungus, deciding if you have enough to work with at that point, or do you need to preserve these for a later use so you can kind of stockpile and get enough to actually work with. And I prefer to dry them, to store them. And there's a couple of reasons why I go that route. So drying them takes out that variable of water weight. So then if you have a dry dye source, then you can measure it, weigh it against the fiber. And so generally mushroom dyes, you want to go at a starting point of one part mushroom to one part fiber by dry weight. So that's pretty similar, I think, to plant dyeing. And then there are some mushrooms that are really strong dyers. You just need, you know, a third of the weight of your fiber to get a really bold result. And I like working with bold colors. I know. So there are times where I'm like, that's not even, that is a failed dye experiment. And somebody will take the yarn and be like, this is so beautiful. How could you say that? But it's like a cool beige or something like that. For me, that's disappointing. I'm really going for bold colors. So a 1-to-1 by dry weight. And then the amount of water doesn't really contribute to the results very much, but you want enough water in there to get things to move around. And I think that's pretty similar to working with other materials. And then you want it to be in contact with the dye for about an hour. And that's also variable depending on the species. So some mushrooms will give you color, your optimal color within 5 minutes. And you, if you know this fungus, then you pull it out right when it looks as good as it can look and not a second longer, which is a really hard call to make. But, and if you left it in for that full hour, you would get a non-optimal color, a color. But if you're aiming for a certain range, pulling it right when it looks peak is best. So, but for the most part, you simmer the mushroom for an hour and then you simmer the fiber in that dye bath for another hour. So it'd be a 2-hour process.
You've collected mushrooms in various parts of North America. Are you tempted to be sort of like a mushroom visitor, a mushroom journeyer?
So I love, and this is just inherent in me, anywhere I go, I'm looking at the ground, I'm looking for some nice habitat. I just am happiest exploring forest land or even just interesting habitats if forests aren't part of that landscape. So I'm looking at animals and insects and lizards and all sorts of things. I'm just curious about nature in general. So I love going to a new place and exploring forested habitat and being a mushroom tourist. And it's really, that is part of what I really love about what I do. And if I see dye mushrooms, I collect them. And within reason, if I'm in an area where it's permitted and whatnot, and then I'll stockpile those until I have a workshop in that area. So I'm prepared to teach just about everywhere.
Wow. So you collect them and then take them home and then take them back? Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
So, and you say you were prepared to teach just about everywhere. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? What are your some of the favorite places you've been to collect, and what are some really exciting places you want to explore more?
Oh my goodness, there's so many places that I want to explore. But I've taught in a lot of places. I've foraged in a lot of places. My most recent, most exciting foraging experience was in Connecticut, where my understanding is that it's legal to collect mushrooms anywhere. Anywhere that it's not determined, I'm sure there's some protected areas where you're not supposed to touch anything, but in most general forests, you can go and you don't have to worry about, there's a lot of rules about collecting on the West Coast that are arbitrary and frustrating to work around. Like in California, there are very few places that you are allowed to collect mushrooms. It's not based on science, it's based on regulation. And that can be very frustrating for people in California. And in Washington, we have rules. You can collect 5 gallons of mushrooms per person per day of edible mushrooms. Mm. Now, why would that be? I don't know. But so I have some crafty stories about how I'm going to eat these mushrooms that are tough and woody and probably not that great. But technically edible is not on the delicious spectrum of edible. So I loved collecting in Connecticut. And, you know, I didn't even really find that many dye mushrooms, but just being allowed to be in nature and look at things without having to worry if somebody's going to scold you or anything like that. And then I'm teaching in Alaska this year. Mm-hmm. Alaska is a really beautiful place and an interesting place for mushrooms. They have a short season and a different selection of colors. So it's similar in a lot of ways to where I live in the Pacific Northwest, but then certain species don't continue up that far up the coast. So just kind of rearranging a little bit my regional dye palette when I'm up there. It's exciting to me.
When you kind of go out into a new place, do you have a sense of what you're looking for? Because presumably there's all kinds of different natural elements. And when you are discerning what to investigate more, what do you think might have some color in it? How do you decide?
Yeah. So there are some certain genera of fungi, Cortinarius, Hydnellums, Sarcodon, and more. And these things grow in certain habitats or with certain trees, some of which I know and some of which I don't know. But I have a general sense of good habitat. And I think everybody has the ability to sense good habitat. You just kind of feel this, you drive out into the wilderness or to the woods and you feel this kind of feeling of comfort wash over you and you think, this is a good habitat. And so think that's a good place to start. When you get into a natural area and you just kind of feel like this, there could be wildlife here. There's some big trees back in there. That's where I start. And then I know that certain trees are required for certain fungi. So I'll start looking for oak trees or start looking for conifer trees. And even though I've never collected in an area before and I'm not familiar with the species as they are, I am familiar enough with the genus that I know what I'm likely to find and what I'm not likely to find. And then I never know if I'm actually going to find any mushrooms that are valuable to me for dyeing, at least. And I am easily entertained in the woods. So I look at all fungi and every find of anything in the natural world that's new to me is exciting. That's part of what I love about this hobby is getting out and exploring. So if you want to find a dye mushroom, you're going to see 60 mushrooms before you get to that dye mushroom. And it causes you to ask questions of, what is this? I wonder if it would work.
And so do you have a way of testing out in the field to say, this is worth bringing home or?
Yeah, I do. Actually, I have this little camp kit that I have. And I don't use this all that often, but I have definitely. And it's a little camp stove, just like one of those, not jet boil, but kind of one of those little tiny camp stoves in a little pot, probably, I don't know, maybe a quart pot. 3 jelly jars. And so I'll take the mushroom in question, simmer that in some water in the little pot, and then I'll take that extract and pour it into the 3 jelly jars. And then I carry with me these little bundles of yarn that have been pre-treated with mordant. And so it's a bundle of 3, usually unmordanted, alum mordanted, and iron mordanted fiber. So once I've got my extract extracted, then I'll pour that into the 3 jars, and then I'll set those back into a water bath so they can continue to be hot and do their magic with the yarn samples. And then the reason I have 3 jars is one of the jars I leave neutral. One I'll add a little vinegar to make it about a pH of 4. And then one I'll add a little bit of ammonia to make it about a pH of 9 or 10. And between all of those variables, I'll have a pretty good picture of whether this mushroom produces dye and if it does, if it's what the best route to color is. So if it's acidic route, and then if alum helps, or if actually unmordanted looks better, or if I get a totally different color with iron.
So it's this small lab experiment that you, this is a very portable laboratory.
Yes. And I've been really surprised at a few mushrooms where I've not known what they're going to do, and then they give me really good color.
That's cool. I think it's really interesting. You said that there's something that stains your hands orange, but it really gives green or purple. There is something about natural dyes where I think there's often like a complementary avocado, which you think would be green, will give a red dye. But right. Pomegranate, which you think would be red, gives a green dye. Things like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Kind of across the color wheel. How much can you really collect? I mean, if I were to go out now, I will probably never be as scientifically minded or as prepared as you are. But if you go out and you say, oh, I see all this mushroom that I know gives a great dye, do you kind of limit yourself to how much you take?
I do. There are so many rules and regulations across the board. In Washington State, the Puget Sound Mycological Society has put together this list of rules and regulations for every agency. And it's like 2 pages long. And they're all just a little bit different. Some places it's totally allowed to pick mushrooms. Other places it's not. Places you would think that it's not, you are allowed. And then edible is thrown in there sometimes. And so on private land, if I had just access to all of the mushrooms, I take mature specimens. I take ones that have already opened up that really look like maybe are decaying on the edge. They're not long for this world. They've done their major role in sexual reproduction, have sent their spores out, and are now on the end side of their life. Those actually often work the best for color anyways. And so those are what I'm collecting. I leave the little ones that haven't opened up yet. And then mushrooms hide. So even if you're after morels right now are just starting to come in, and that's the edible mushroom that everybody gets very excited about. And you collect them all. If it's smaller than your pinky nail, you might leave it. But people are out there combing the earth for these things. And even if you try to collect all of the mushrooms, you're never going to see them all. There's always some that are left behind. And they, with morels at least, they'll be back next year if the conditions are right. And chanterelles too. So the edible mushrooms are like that. The organism is underground. So when you collect the aerial parts above ground, they are just the sexual reproductive structure. So you want to make sure that it's done its role in nature. And then that's what I look for, mature specimens.
Just as sort of a detour, thinking about collecting and how much you can collect safely, one of the subjects I think is kind of hotly debated is lichens, which it's kind of astonishing that lichens produce dye and this crazy range of colors. And whether it's safe or wise to collect them is so regionally varied.
Yeah. And you know, with mushrooms too, but lichens really, they have a different set of rules, and ethical harvest is a really strong part of collecting lichens. For lichens, you want to make sure that you're in an area of abundance, and then you want to make sure that they're detached from their happy growing place. That's the way that I describe it, at least. Lichens have a very specific requirement for growth and life. And when they come down from windfall, from the upper canopy of the forest, and now they're on the forest floor. They'll stick around for a little while, but they're on their way out. They do not have the nutrients and the airflow and all of the things that they had at the top of the tree. So lichens that have become detached and are no longer in their happy growing place is the place, one place to start with lichen collecting. You also don't want to collect anything that you only see one specimen of. For lichens, it takes 2 to 3 times the weight of the dried lichen to the dried yarn to give you a good solid color. And in some regions, lichens are not that common. In Europe, they're very protected for that reason. They're just not that common. And part of that's the tree, the forest canopy is not as abundant as it is here in certain parts of the US. So I'll go to a place in nature here, and there'll be abundant heaps and piles of lichens after a windfall. And I could collect all day and not make a dent in the visual aspect of the windfall. Like, there's just a ton. But you definitely, you want to keep in mind what the amount of lichens that you're collecting, even from windfall, because they do contribute to the soil web. They release nutrients back into the soil. And I am more conscientious, definitely paying close attention to what I'm doing with lichens. And then, of course, never harvesting them from rocks or other solid structures, gravestones. There are places that are pressure washed down, including cemeteries, but lichens love growing in cemeteries. And I always kind of encourage people to, if you have a cemetery close to you that's covered in beautiful lichens, rather than going and scraping them off of the tombstones, encouraging the caretakers to let them grow within reason. So not just going through with a chemical wash to kill off all the lichens annually. And then in the case that you're not going to be able to reason with the caretakers, then of course, maybe talking to them, having them notify you a couple of days before they do the big eradication. And then that is a form of ethical harvest. But so I say anything that's not in its happy place or destined for destruction, those are places to look for lichens.
It is very different. I live in northern Colorado where there are lots of lichens, but they're very slow growing and they're all on rocks. Mm.
Yes.
And then I was on the East Coast in Vermont recently, and it was just, there was lichen on the ground, and it wasn't quite as abundant as what you're talking about, but there was no shortage of lichen, and it rains and there it makes more.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. And Colorado is a place that is, I would be very protective of the lichens. And they're, you know, they're performing their function in nature. And people often will say, well, if it's in my own backyard, then what difference does it make? But I just encourage people to let happy lichens do their function in nature and only collect things that are detached.
What is their function?
Well, that's a good question. It probably contains a lot more chemistry than I can go into, but they're a food source for things. They hold moisture. They release enzymes that take minerals.
So they have sort of a chemical aspect and a biological aspect. So even though they're not super active, they're still important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it, I mean, here, like I said, you can be in lichens that have been raining down from the trees and are ankle deep. And there are animals that eat those lichens. There are things that take cover under there. There are nutrients that are released from the decomposition of those lichens. So it's definitely not something that you want to just start scooping up in totality, but taking small amounts. There's probably, I know that as far as windfall goes, there's probably an ethical harvest percentage that would be more accurate. But those percentages get me because, well, what if you're collecting lichens in a place that's really heavily populated and it's the new thing to do? And so everybody goes out and takes their 5% or whatever, then sooner or later, you're going to see a decline.
It's a really difficult question because I think, you know, you're talking about how a lot of these natural elements like lichens and fungi are performing a function, But we also think of them as being as natural dyes and natural dye sources as being more environmentally beneficial, depending how you do it, but in general, more environmentally beneficial than something synthetic. So it's kind of difficult. How do you decide what to do?
Yeah. And I think that lies within the person. You know, not everybody is comfortable going out into the woods and wild harvesting everything, thankfully, because there probably isn't enough for
everybody.
It'd
be very crowded out there.
Yes. I hardly ever see anybody in the woods. Almost. And I get worried about the popularization of foraging. I know during the early days of the pandemic, everybody was outside. And it was a biohazard issue because I don't think people had ever gone to the bathroom in the woods before. And so there's toilet paper everywhere and people everywhere and dirt roads are a parking lot. And I was worried there for a minute, but you know, the next year there weren't so many people. And now I expect to see people in the woods and I very, very rarely see people out mushroom hunting, which makes me feel a little bit better. But one of the more promising things is people are starting to really explore cultivating some of these dye sources. And I've seen that people are able to get dyers polypore in culture and are seeing some promising results from that. And I've been into mycology and looking at mushrooms since 1998. And people have talked about cultivating these things, and it's always been kind of a dead end. Well, you can't do that because they rely on all of these different elements to make a fruiting body in the woods. But people are starting to find ways to do that. And so I think that there is some potential for developing mushroom colors in a more sustainable commercial way, for better or for worse, hopefully for the better.
That is really cool. I mean, the idea that, because if you're interested in natural dyeing with, for example, a lot of the woods, logwood, Brazil wood, et cetera,
yeah,
you can just buy that from somebody.
Yeah.
But currently, if you're interested in mushroom dyeing, it's very much a do-it-yourself kind of endeavor.
Right.
And I suppose that's why people come and learn from you, right? Because you know how to do it and very few people do.
I love teaching people the depth of color that can be found in their own forests. And a lot of people who take my classes maybe have not explored the forest so much for color, or they have dye gardens and things that they've cultivated. So it's a very different approach to, I guess what I love about it is the kind of randomness to the dye palette in the end. So one of my favorite experiences with mushroom dyeing is to go out into the woods for a day and do forage around with people or friends and collect the things that I come across that make dyes and then have a collection from a day. So like a daily palette of color. And you never know what you're going to get in that daily palette. And it can memorialize an event that you went to or an experience you had in the woods. And I might have purple and orange mittens. And, you know, I don't know that's what color my mittens are going to be before I go out and actually experience the forest. So I love that aspect of it. Where if you're plotting out a dye garden, you're going to be like, you have more control over what colors your palette might be.
You've mentioned dyers polypore. Is that your favorite or do you have a favorite?
Boy, I don't have a favorite. Dyers polypore is probably in the top five. It's super common. It's a pathogen on conifers. It grows in a lot of different places. I don't know the widespreadness of dyers polypore, but it's found all over. I'm pretty sure it's found all over the world. And it has so much color potential in it. So if you find a young, fresh dyers polypore, I use one part dried to almost five parts fiber.
Wow.
So it really has a lot of dye in it. But I, you know, the dyes are like my pets. I get joy from each one in a different way. And every time I teach, I have that opportunity to discover these colors again. And I often use whatever water is available at the workshop as part of that color palette experience. And the colors are just, it's a surprise every time in some sense, even though I know what colors to expect. I'll look back over my record cards from all of the classes, and there's a lot of variation just due to all of the subtleties that go into it.
It sounds like embracing as a benefit as opposed to a detriment, the fact that this stuff is really not repeatable. There is no regular color. There's no dye lot, no colorway. It's sort of experimental, one of a kind.
I love that aspect. Mm-hmm. And it would be really fun to create a project out of that variation, just like all one species, but from all of the different dye baths that it takes to make up enough fiber to do a project.
So do you have a whole bunch of jars of little colors? Is it, do you have sort of an old-fashioned pharmacy?
I do. I stockpile for classes. So I have at least 2 years worth of classes stored away. So if I am called to teach in the Northeast, I can get together the colors that I would like to use for that palette. Each class is customized to the specific region and the specific place. So I use iNaturalist as a tool to help me kind of come up with my palette from the things that are most common or the things that are common that year. So I try to really dial it into what people are going to be experiencing. So if it's at the beginning of the season, then I'll try to find some things in my stash that are like more early season things so that people can really, my ideal situation is that they take the class and they head right out to the woods the next weekend and start collecting and start experimenting and getting these colors, start learning about these fungal systems.
That's a lot of work on your part to make something that feels spontaneous on the student's part.
I love it though. I've been doing this now for 11 years and it's, every class that I teach is very exciting for me.
And so it also seems like you could take a class in different parts of the country or different parts of the world and have a really different experience.
Yeah. And I'm trying to add more field days into my workshop so that people can go out for half of a day and get a feel for what it's like to actually get into the woods and look at mushrooms and the language used to describe what they see. It's different than botanical terminology. And it doesn't have to be the really heavy scientific terminology, but just even knowing where to look for different features, it can be really enlightening. I take it UV light so people can see different UV reactions, which can help with identification as well.
Wow, that's really cool. Coming back full circle to the basic understanding of wild mushrooms, are there safety precautions that people should take when looking for dye mushrooms? I mean, aside from like, don't stick everything in your mouth?
Yeah. Starting at the beginning, you definitely want to like let somebody know where you're going in the woods for the day. Going out in the woods is probably the most dangerous aspect of any of this without a good plan and packing for the elements and things like that. But as far as safety precautions go, you can touch all mushrooms without having any, you don't need to have any fear of being poisoned through transdermal process, like going through your skin. Mushroom toxins are large and are not absorbed through mucous membranes, unlike plant toxins. So if you go on a foray with a mycologist, you'll often see them doing this chew and spit test, which is to identify some species of mushrooms that look very similar to other species. You'll take a little nibble and spit it out and note the taste on your tongue. So I don't recommend this as a starting point for beginners, but it is something that you might see while you're out on a mushroom foray with somebody who knows what they're doing. So that's mushroom toxins. You have to actually ingest the mushroom to be sickened by them. But then there's snakes, poison ivy, poison oak, and those kinds of things that you probably want to take into consideration when going out into the woods.
Wow, that's cool. I really never knew that. It seems like something that could be very dangerous would just be universally that you would have to be careful any way you were exposed to it.
Yeah. And I mean, there's the ick factor that mushrooms, there are larvae and molds and other unpleasant smells and things when you're collecting rotten mushrooms for the dye pot. So I'll generally wear some garden gloves, but in general. And then there's also contact dermatitis. Some people are sensitive to more things than others. lichens can are known for having that effect on some people. So wearing gloves when collecting lichens is something that I do.
So speaking of lichens, my husband is from India and he has a recipe that calls for something called stone flower. And we finally found it in an Indian grocery store and it's a lichen. And So you do use just a little bit and it adds a particular kind of fragrance to the food. But, you know, my Linda Ligon was very excited about lichen dyeing. And so I bought her a bag and she did an extraction on it. It gives this great magenta dye. Otherwise, it's just, I think it's a pulmonaria lichen. I'm not positive about that, but, and it just has this wonderful fragrant and lichen dyed yarn smells so good.
Yeah, I love the smell of lichen dyed yarn. This particular lichen it's interesting because it's described as being a specific species of lichen. And if you've ever looked at lichens, you will notice that a lot of them look almost exactly the same as each other. So until you train your eye to notice subtle color differences, and then that's only the very first step of lichen identification. A lot of lichens require microscopy to really get down to the species. And so I think that this is the case with this particular lichen, is that it is, the spice probably came from a regional culinary palate. And then now that it's popularized more through just the growth of humankind, it's now for sale. So it's monetized. And then, so then it's, somebody is being paid to collect it. And do they know how to identify it particularly? Does it really matter? A lot of lichens have similar essences, flavors, or fragrance profiles. So the original description that I read about that spice is that it is a specific species, and I can't remember, I think it's a Parmelia, but it is chlorine negative, which means that when you scratch the little algae layer off the top and you put a drop of bleach on there, that is a chemistry test that lichenologists do to differentiate certain lichens from each other. And so when you do that for the spice lichen, it should not turn red. And the lichens that give you that magenta dye do turn red.
Oh.
With the chlorine test.
How funny.
Yeah. So the fact that Linda was able to get that beautiful magenta tells me that that lichen is not what it's supposed to be.
That's so funny. Wow.
And I know a lot of people are excited about that color. If you haven't seen that color, it is like a blinding, beautiful magenta color. It is, I think it's in our core animal being to be attracted to this form of magenta color. But lichen dyes that are extracted in ammonia that make these beautiful magenta colors, they're beautiful, but they fade in sunlight. So they have, I guess, qualities that are very attractive. And then from a professional dyer perspective, qualities that are not so attractive and that they fade. And I think it's human nature to want that color. And it seems like an easy answer to just go to the store and buy that color, to buy the lichen. But the fact that it's being collected and it's not the species that it says it is, tells me that it's not being ethically harvested either. So I avoid purchasing lichens. And this is a rule that goes back to Karen Castleman, who wrote Lichen Dyes, the New Source book. And that's one of her top five rules, is that you should not purchase lichens because it encourages overharvest. And so that's from a dyer's perspective. There's a lot of different ways. I'm not saying people shouldn't add the spice to their food. That's a personal choice. But as far as, there are so many other ways to access lichens in an ethical way, that supporting an unethical trade is something that I avoid and I encourage people to avoid.
So you would not recommend going to the Indian grocery store and buying them out of these bags of stone flower?
As tempting as it is.
Yeah.
I think there are better ways to come across that lichen and or a lichen similar that makes the same color. And so you can find that lichen in abundance in certain areas in the U.S., that lichens that produce that color just from windfall.
Wow.
So.
That's so interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
And I don't think that cooking with lichen is a very common is something I was exposed to. I was shocked when I saw this. I was like, that's what's in the recipe? But
yeah, it is interesting. I've eaten lichen a couple of times. There's a Korean spice of lichen that I've had, and I think it's more textural than flavorful, but I can see the essence. I know from my wool that's dyed with lichens, it has its own unique fragrance, every lichen, and particularly fond of a few of the species.
You know, I suppose the color and the flavor are not related, but both of these traits that make something incredibly appealing to us, even though it may not be intrinsically useful to the original plant. It's just so fascinating in terms of how we relate to the natural world.
Right. How did we figure out how to get purple out of lichens? Mm-hmm. And these lichens are green or gray, you know?
Yeah. It's true. So what are you excited about next? What are you working on?
Oh my goodness. I have a lot of exciting workshops coming up. I'm teaching in Oaxaca. And when I go to Mexico, I am as much of a student as my teacher. And so I am really excited to, this will be my third year of studying and teaching in Oaxaca. And so that's something I'm really looking forward to. It's working with indigenous communities using fiber sources. This year we're visiting a silk village and working with silk and wild fungi that grow in the area. So just seeing that come to fruition, and mushrooms and lichens aren't part of that, or I should say mushrooms are not part of that traditional dye palette. Lichens go back. Every culture figured out the lichen thing and utilized the lichen thing from time immemorial. Why mushrooms aren't part of that tradition, I'm not sure, but lichens definitely go back to the beginning. So yeah, I'm really excited about Oaxaca. And there are a lot of places on my list, and I can't name them off because I don't have any favorites necessarily, but I am really excited about going back to Alaska. It's been about 4 or 5 years since I've been there. And so getting a chance to experience Alaskan dye palettes again is on the top of my list. I'm teaching in Northern California in April at the Fiber Shed Learning Center. And Northern California is really fun because they just have all the mushrooms and all the lichens. So all of the top favorite colors be showcased in that class.
And if people wanted to find your workshops, is that on your website?
Yes, mycopigments.com.
And it's MYCO, right?
Mm-hmm. MYCOPIGMENTS.com. And then for people who are just learning about mushroom and lichen dyeing, I started a Facebook group early in this adventure of mine. And as a way to reach out to my students after the workshops, and then also reach people in communities where I couldn't. I try to teach as many classes as I can, but there are places that are definitely that I haven't been to as frequently as I'd like to. And so I started this discussion group. I think it's 2013, and it has grown to 35,000 members all over the world, and everybody helps everybody. So I'm not the only one answering the questions anymore. It's really a community resource, and it reaches all over the world. So if you are in a place far away from the Pacific Northwest, you can find community within that group of people who are experimenting with these things. So I am very proud of that group. And I just, every day I wake up and look at the exchanges, and it's a very loving community. It makes me happy.
That's great. Well, Alyssa, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Anne. Appreciate you having this podcast, and look forward to catching up on some of the episodes that I've missed.
Thanks to our sponsors for supporting the podcast. Thank you for listening to the Long Thread Podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please rate the show and leave us a comment on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast platform. Thanks again.